content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and welcome to the Spring 2015 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and cassette. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. If you are not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program. This month, we'll take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the month of April 2015 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Our first book for this month is The Assassin, an Isaac Bell adventure by Clive Cussler along with Justin Scott. And if you haven't been spellbound by Van Dorn private detective Isaac Bell by this time, then The Assassin will make you a fan. The ability of Clive Cussler to fine-tune characters, set them in near impossible situations, and spin a multifaceted plot is storytelling genius. In 1905, the Van Dorns are hired by the government to investigate John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil for monopolistic activities. The investigation takes Bell to Kansas City, where a brawny Pete Straub and his men block his locomobile with wagons. Straub, a Standard Oil policeman, bellows at Bell, "Go back where you came from. We'll fire any man who talks to you," and they know it. Bell uses both fisticuffs and an automatic pistol to clear his way forward. He heads south and west across the state line into Kansas, throttles the car, and heads into the prairie. When he arrives at the Hopewell Refinery, named for its owner, Spike Hopewell, Bell is impressed by the sheer size of storage tanks and capacity for refining crude oil. One of the independent wildcatters who opposed Rockefeller, Hopewell is proud of his achievement, but fearful that Standard's lawyers will snuff his effort to transport product. He seeks to construct a massive pipeline to shift the oil from his tanks to buyers at the Gulf of Mexico. Standard Oil has him tied up in court. His tanks will provide storage and processing for the other independents in Kansas, Oklahoma, and parts nearby. Before Bell meets Hopewell and tours the refinery, Cussler explores the psyche of an assassin, a skilled marksman whose expertise is unrivaled. The killer discloses his means and method for each kill. Bell aims to talk Hopewell into testifying against Rockefeller with proof that Straub's men destroyed railroad tracks meant to ship the oil to markets east of Kansas. Spike remains certain that he will win the fight in the courthouse, protecting himself and his friends from ruin. Facing bankruptcy 5 years earlier, Spike and his partner Bill Matters were given the opportunity to join Standard. Matters went with Rockefeller, and Hopewell headed to Kansas. Bell's fact-finding trip is literally blown apart when the assassin fires a calculated shot from nearly 700 yards away, killing Hopewell, with a second shot narrowly missing Bell. Trying to foil the man's escape, Bell manages a shot with his rifle but fails. Back in the refinery, a third shot rings out. Bell is horrified to see a dynamite-rigged device attached to an oil tank explode, setting off multiple fires. The gas explosion sets the oil burning, threatening the entire operation. Cussler and Scott describe Bell's daring bravado with minute details, bringing down a giant gasoline tank. Rivers of gasoline overcome flying embers from the burning oil, drowning them. The murder and havoc wreaked in Hopewell's yard bring an onslaught of curiosity seekers, reporters, and journalists to view the damage. Bell meets E.M. Hawk in a tent, reporting her view of the events. Her article accuses wildcatters hired by Standard Oil of the destruction. She confronts Bell about his experience with the oil business, learning that he has read her previous essays. She differs from her father, Bill Matters, on the part Standard Oil now plays, but loves him unconditionally. Traveling with her is her half-sister, Nell. Both girls are beauties who Belle finds enticing. A suffragist, Nell is the more aggressive of the two. Her mantra is to pilot a balloon from which she displays advertisements for women's right to vote. The major players have been introduced, but Kussler introduces another to increase the tension. Enter John D. Rockefeller, semi-retired chairman of Standard Oil, the magnate most in his business despise. Belle convinces Rockefeller himself that competitors want him killed and that he needs personal protection. During this time, three of Standard Oil's executives are murdered. Belle now has himself a client. Rockefeller has secrets, but insists that Mattis and Belle accompany him to Russia to the Baku oil fields on business. Mattis' two daughters accompany them on the lengthy trip, Edna on assignment for the New York Sun and Nellie for company. The authors use the journey as a storyteller's paradise, complete with Persian royalty, the Russian Cossacks' civil war, and, of course, a near assassination. Along with former Van Dorn associates, Belle manages their escape from the fighting that threatens them. The subplot here is Belle's recovery of two parts of the assassin's rifle with hollow point ammunition. Aided by Van Dorn research and manpower, he seeks the man who has engineered the gun for the assassin. When he finds the source, a more sinister plan with enhanced capacity is uncovered. It is now a race to find and kill the assassin. The assassin is spellbinding with Isaac Belle's career racing at top speed. Imaginative circumstances, compelling action, colorful characters, and word pictures of early days in the American oil industry make for an outstanding thriller. And that book, The Assassin, was reviewed by Judy Gigstad in March of this year. It's The Assassin, an Isaac Belle adventure by Clive Cussler and Justin Scott. And our next book that was really popular for the month of April is one that I'll bet that you have heard about. It just seemed to have come right out of the blue. It's called The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. I have been on board the praise train for The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins since I first started reading it, the reviewer says. I clearly remember picking it up late one Thursday night, getting about 10 pages in, and forcing myself to stop. I knew that if I kept reading, there was no way I was going to be able to put it down, and I had a huge day of my Friday writing scheduled for the next day. But as soon as I typed the last word that Friday, I dashed forward to start reading and did not stop until I was done. The reviewer says, I now understand why a child feels like being told to stop playing a video game is to do homework. You know how they feel. They just don't want to do it. Well, anyway, here's how I've been pitching it. Rachel takes the train to London each day, and it often stops on the tracks at the same location to wait for train traffic ahead to clear. From there, she watches a group of houses and the action happening in those houses. She is particularly intrigued by a young couple in one of the houses whom she calls Jess and Jason. One day she learns that Jess has gone missing and immediately gets caught up in what happened to this woman, who she finds out is actually named Megan. But is Rachel a reliable narrator of this story? You must read to decide. I raced through it, thinking Hitchcock would have loved this. Now, those who have the same commute or travel patterns each day can relate to those slices of life that we see but just do not know about. What are you really seeing? Is it the whole story? Well, for many good editorial reasons, not just hype, this book is being compared to Gone Girl. Confession here, I was not the biggest Gone Girl fan once the reveal happened. I felt the story slowed considerably, and I was uninterested. That never happened with The Girl on the Train. It was a book that had and then another after that. I also loved The Silent Wife, which showed me some of the same strains of continuously pulling me along. And on the up all night theme, after I finished, says this reviewer, I handed it to my husband. When he looked up again, he was on page 175. It's definitely a book you want to clear your schedule to read, especially since a lot of people will be talking about it. And care to think about how to cast the movie? Because I'm sure there will be a movie that will be produced from this book. And although I was reading the words of another reviewer, I can personally tell you that I have read this book, and it is exactly that way. It is definitely a page-turner. It's a good one. It's called The Girl on the Train. It's been on the top 50 list here for probably ever since it came out 6 months ago, I think, or close to it. Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. I think you'll enjoy that one. Now let's move on to another popular author who is always, virtually always, on our list at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. This is called NYPD Red 3, and it's by James Patterson, this time along with Marshall Karp. The NYPD Red series by James Patterson is a great example of plotting outside the box. The series concerns a special division of the NYPD that, rather than dealing with the hoi polloi, concerns itself with the travails of New York's rich and powerful. While there are those who argue that New York's finest constitute a law unto themselves, NYPD Red answers to its police captain, who, in matters red, answers to the mayor. The go-to members of the squad are Detectives Zach Jordan and Kylie McDonald, who have a romantic history that is past tense and a professional history in the here and now that includes some sharp-edged repartee between them as they engage in high-speed trips to crime scenes and the mayor's office, all the while ignoring their lingering feelings for each other. That is really all of the backstory you need to know if NYPD Red 3 is your first encounter with the elite squad. And it's one that you will definitely want to pick up and take with you on your way to spring break or wherever you're planning to be an active participant or intending to just observe the festivities. Things begin in fine Patterson-like fashion with the introduction of Hunter Henderson Alden Jr., a ruthless financier with a reputation to match. We meet Alden at the beginning of the new year as he receives notice that Tripp, his teenage son, has been kidnapped and is being held for ransom, a notification that is accompanied by the grisly presentation of the head of Peter, the family's longtime chauffeur. Alden's reaction to all of this is somewhat bizarre, to say the least, given that he attempts to keep Tripp's abduction and Peter's noggin a secret from one and all, including his wife and the police. The discovery of Peter's headless body next to Alden's missing limo in Central Park soon puts Jordan and McDonald on the case and results in a significant bit of pairing and thrusting as Alden pulls power and rank by obstructing justice. The mayor, who was elected in no small part as a result of the financial contributions of Alden's father, enables him to get away with it to some degree. There's still, however, the matter of Tripp's kidnapping. Now, lest you think that NYPD Red 3 is a simple matter of Jordan and McDonald hunting down a missing high school student whose father insists is not missing at all, think again. Jordan's abduction is not merely a case of ransom, but one of blackmail as well. Alden is not highly regarded by the public at large, but even as he has secrets that he hopes will never see the light of day, the person or persons who know those secrets plan to use the enormous payoff that they are demanding toward very different ends. Jordan and McDonald have to put their personal issues with themselves and their respective significant others on hold while they sort things out. The problem is that almost everyone they talk to is lying to them. Their only hope of solving this mystery and perhaps saving Tripp's life in the bargain lies with two very unusual and highly surprising sources that in turn lead them to a couple of the biggest surprises of all. There's an even bigger problem facing Jordan and McDonald. Even if they're able to close the case, can they achieve justice? The conclusion provides the answer and more. Now, Patterson and Carr provide plenty of surprises throughout NYPD Red 3. That's number 3 is the title of the book. As a bonus, they also inject a number of New York factoids into the narrative. While they don't go overboard on them, there are certainly enough to give even a native New Yorker pause and education. While those of us who live elsewhere might want to check out some of the landmarks mentioned on our next visit, Patterson and Karp have a winning formula here that does not read like formula writing at all, and hopefully will continue for some time to come. And that review was done by Joe Hartlob in March of 2015. This is a brand new book, and it was actually number 2 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind just this past month. And moving right along, our next book for this month is called Motive by Jonathan Kellerman. Kellerman writes razor-sharp novels that cut to the quick. Now comes Motive, which pits psychologist Alex Delaware and homicide cop Milo Sturgis against a vicious criminal mind, the kind only Kellerman can bring to chilling life. Even having hundreds of closed cases to his credit can't keep LAPD Police Lieutenant Milo Sturgis from agonizing over the crimes that don't get solved and the victims who go without justice. Victims like Catherine Hennepin, a young woman strangled and stabbed in her home. A single suspect with a solid alibi leads to a dead end, one even Alex Delaware's expert insight can't explain. The only thing to do is move on to the next murder case, because there's always a next one. This time, the victim is Ursula Corey, a successful, attractive divorcee who's been gunned down, not a robbery, but an execution, a crime that smacks of simple, savage revenge. And along with that theoretical motive come two strong contenders for the role of Perp: the dead woman's business partner, ex-husband, and her divorce lawyer and secret lover. But just as Alex and Milo think they're zeroing in on the most likely suspect, a bizarre new clue stirs up eerie echoes of the unsolved Hennepin murder and the discovery of yet another crime scene bearing the same taunting signature. Raises the specter of a serial killer on a mission whose twisted method is exceeded only by his manipulative and cunning madness. Sounds like kind of a scary one there. That's called Motive, and it's by the very popular author Jonathan Kellerman. Now, another author who's on our list a lot of the time on this program is Sandra Brown, and this is a new book called Envy. The prologue of a novel arrives in the Manhattan offices of a book editor who's intrigued enough to chase its mysterious author, identified only by its initials, to his decrepit plantation on an island off the Georgia coast. Now, that's the first clue that fiction is stranger than fact. Few publishers, if any, would go to that sort of trouble for anything less than a new J.D. Salinger novel. But best-selling author Sandra Brown makes the most of her far-fetched premise, setting up on a convoluted plot that keeps the reader engrossed despite its flaws and foibles. So this is a book about a book being written. Maris Matherly Reed is more than an editor. She's also the beloved daughter of the publishing house's highly respected and successful leader, and the wife of Matherly Press's second-in-command, the smooth, suave, double-dealing Noah Reed. Reed, it develops, is the real target of the literary scam set up by the reclusive writer of the novel, whose opening pages so captivate Reed's spouse. PME, those are the initials, that's all we know about this writer. The writer of this mystery book here has a score to settle with Maris's husband, and he doesn't care whom he hurts as long as he brings Noah down. At least not until he meets Maris, who has an unfortunate habit of falling in love with her authors. Brown is a master at romantic suspense, and Envy displays the talents that have won her a devoted following. A deft hand at evoking the vulnerability and humanity of her protagonists, a sure command of narrative tension, and a nice sense of place. This is a terrific hammock read, just right for a summer day as sultry and humid as Envy's low country setting. And that review, by the way, was written by Jane Addams. The book is Envy by Sandra Brown. Yet another popular author is Nora Roberts. I'm sure you've read something by her before. She has a relatively new book out called Sacred Sins. Let's read about that one now. Combining explosive suspense with sensual passion, Nora Roberts turns up the heat in this classic tale, the sizzling story of a man and woman on the trail of a demented killer, a search that will plunge them headlong into danger. In the lazy days of summer, a merciless heat wave is the biggest story in Washington, D.C. But the weather is knocked off the front pages when a young woman is found strangled to death. A note left behind reads, "Her sins are forgiven her." Two more victims soon follow, and suddenly every headline is devoted to the killer the press has dubbed the priest. When the police ask top-notch psychiatrist Dr. Tess Court to help with their investigation, she comes up with a disturbing portrait of a twisted soul. Detective Ben Paris doesn't give a damn about the killer's psyche. What he can't easily dismiss is Tess, tall, dark, and good-looking. Ben has a legendary reputation with women, but the coolly elegant Tess doesn't react to him like other women he knows, and he finds the challenge enticing. Now, as the two are thrown together in a perilous quest to stop a serial killer, the flame of white-hot passion flares, but someone also has his eyes on the beautiful blonde doctor. And Ben can only pray that if the madman strikes, he'll be able to stop him before it's too late. It's called Sacred Sins, and it is by Nora Roberts. Here's an author that, quite honestly, I used to read all the time, and I haven't in recent years, and I need to get back to her. I'm pretty sure she's a good one. Her name is Patricia Cornwell, of course you know, and the book that was very popular last month from the North Carolina Library for the Blind was called Flesh and Blood. Here's what it's all about. It's Dr. Kay Scarpetta's birthday, and she's about to head to Miami for a vacation with Benton Wellesley, or rather Wesley, her FBI profiler husband, when she notices seven pennies on a wall behind their Cambridge house. Is this a kid's game? If so, why are all of the coins dated 1981 and so shiny they could be newly minted? Well, her cell phone rings, and Detective Pete Marino tells her there's been a homicide 5 minutes away. A high school music teacher has been shot with uncanny precision as he unloaded groceries from his car. No one has heard or seen a thing. In this 20-second Scarpetta novel, the master forensic sleuth finds herself in the unsettling pursuit of a serial sniper who leaves no incriminating evidence except fragments of copper. The shots seem impossible, yet they are so perfect they cause instant death. The victims appear to have had nothing in common, and there's no pattern to indicate where the killer will strike next. First, New Jersey, then Massachusetts, then the murky depths off the coast of South Florida, where Scarpetta investigates a shipwreck, looking for answers that only she can discover and analyze. And it is there that she comes face to face with shocking evidence that implicates her techno-genius niece, Lucy, Scarpetta's own flesh and blood. And that book, again, is called Flesh and Blood, and it was written by Patricia Cornwell. Here's another popular book from this past month. It's by Marcia Clark, and it's called Guilt by Degrees. Here's the review. Rachel Knight, a member of the Special Trials Unit at the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, takes on a nearly impossible assignment. Prosecute the killer of a homeless man, a crime that has no suspects or motive, in Guilt by Degrees, the second legal thriller in this series by Marcia Clark. The case was nearly thrown out for lack of intent to prosecute when Rachel stepped in to accept it. Her legal partner, Tony LaCollier, and Detective Bailey Keller agree to help her get started. The dead man, known only as John Doe to the courts, is finally identified as Simon Bear, and in an apparently bizarre coincidence, he is the brother of slain police officer Zach Bear. Bear's wife, Lila, was prosecuted for the crime, but was found not guilty just 2 months earlier. Could it be possible these two cases are linked? How? Why? The answers to these questions are apparently to be found in the streets of L.A., where vagrants, beggars, and the homeless are in possession of the information that Rachel needs. This intense and riveting thriller has created drawn characters racing against time in the context of a convincing law and order-driven investigation. There's a good balance between nerve-wracking scenes of danger and lighthearted banter between friends. But it is the solid murder mystery at the core of Guilt by Degrees and the enemy that Rachel Knight is forced to face that is its most strongly developed element, one that elevates it to the top tier of legal thrillers to be published this year. This is a book not to be missed, according to the guest reviewer from The Best Review for contributing her review of Guilt by Degrees. That's The Betz, B-E-T-Z, review. Guilt by Degrees by Marcia Clark. And we just have time for one more quick book. This is an author that got me hooked on murder mysteries probably 30 or 40 years ago, I think. Mary Higgins Clark. It's called The Cinderella Murder, and she wrote it in collaboration with Alifair Burke. Television producer Lori Moran is delighted when the pilot for her reality drama, Under Suspicion, is a success. Even more, the program, a cold case series that revisits unsolved crimes by recreating them with those affected, is off to a fantastic start when it helps solve an infamous murder in the very first episode. Now Lori has the ideal case to feature in the next episode of Under Suspicion, The Cinderella Murder. When Susan Dempsey, a beautiful and multi-talented UCLA student, was found dead, her murder raised numerous questions. Why was her car parked miles from her body? Had she ever shown up for the acting audition she was due to attend at the home of an up-and-coming director? Why does Susan's boyfriend want to avoid questions about their relationship? Was her disappearance connected to a controversial church that was active on campus? Was she close to her computer science professor because of her technological brilliance or something more? And why was Susan missing one of her shoes when her body was discovered? Hence Cinderella, I guess. Well, the help of lawyer and Under Suspicion host Alex Buckley, Lori knows the case will attract great ratings, especially when the former suspects include Hollywood's elite and tech billionaires. The suspense and drama are perfect for the silver screen. But is Cinderella's murderer ready for a close-up? The Cinderella Murder by Mary Higgins Clark. And that's all for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately. I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the NCLBPH, the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search the NC Library for the Blind or call toll-free 1-888-388-2460. This program is intended for a print and visually handicapped audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.